Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to the Hot Shot Wake Up. This is your weekly wildfire update. Thanks for tuning in. Slow week here as we exit April in the wildfire world. Europe has slowed down. The United States has slowed down. There's a couple of smaller fires up in British Columbia that are burning, but nothing that's really out of control or anything like that. It's these early season fires up there. New Mexico had a larger grass fire, but they wrapped that up after it went over 1,000 acres. That was down near Las Vegas, New Mexico, where the Calf Canyon Hermit's Peak fire was. But a bunch of engines and tenders wrapped that thing up. It was called the Marsh Fire. East Coast has calmed down as well, kind of a weather pattern pushing across the United States. That being said, that warmer weather is coming across the West Coast, pushing into Region 1, Region 4, and even down in the Southwest. Right now, there's parts of New Mexico where it's snowing. So really, it just depends where you are. South Ops in California had a fire called the Knob Fire. That created some confusion at first. ABC7, the local ABC station out there, had talked to someone who was a part of the county, or at least this is what the story is, and they said that it was a controlled burn that had been lost. So that got passed around, and I shared a screenshot of the ABC News helicopter where they said it was a lost controlled burn, but then very quickly afterwards, the San Bernardino Forest came out and said, hey, that's not what's going on. People reached out to me and said, hey, yeah, it's not a controlled burn. There was a misstep or someone misspoke about what was taking place there. Anyway, that's the Knob Fire. A couple hotshot crews tried to wrangle that thing in, lots of air resources, and a spattering of smaller fires around the nation. But it's been quiet as we push into May, and then we'll have to keep our eyes up to see what happens then. Alaska's saying they might have a season start in May. And I'm sure if the season is going to come down in Region 3, we'll start seeing those timber fires if it dries out and things start to cure out. But other than that, there's not a lot going on in the wildfire world when it comes to active wildfires. Of course, there is some news that has come out. We're going to cover it. On the second segment, we'll talk about the huge lawsuit against PacifiCorp up in Oregon, and all the damage and property loss there from multiple wildfires, fires that burned in the Willamette National Forest. And basically, it's lawsuits against another power company. And the state is suing, and residents are suing, saying, hey, this was negligence that you didn't power down your power systems and lines in areas where there was heavy vegetation. And the state is saying, hey, we reached out to the power company and told them to turn it off. And we gave them plenty of warnings that this was going to happen. And allegedly, they didn't do that. All these fires started. The interesting part of that to me is that the parent company is Berkshire Hathaway, which is owned by Warren Buffett, one of the largest companies on the planet. And it's a $1.6 billion class action case. And really, no one's talking about it, except for these folks out in Oregon who wrote an article on it, and we're going to cover that. But first, there's a couple things going on in Montana and Idaho that I think are worth covering that might end up being a shift in how initial attacks are done and who's allowed to be on initial attacks. We'll cover what's happening in Montana first. It's an article out of NBC Montana entitled "Lawmakers Considering a Bill to Boost Montana's Wildfire Fighting Capabilities." So we'll take you through this. It says Montana lawmakers are considering a bill to boost the state's wildfire fighting capabilities, and a local aerial firefighting company is weighing in on what difference this House Bill 883 could make. Bridger Aerospace, they're based out of Bozeman, Montana, for folks who don't know who Bridger Aerospace is. It says that they, who are the home of the largest fleet of super scoopers, knows attacking a fire requires a rapid response, but right now they say firefighters sometimes are forced to wait for federal resources. When wildfires start in Montana, quote, there's a delayed reaction because the federal agencies, and not really by any fault of their own, but they have to cover the whole country from Alaska to Florida and everywhere in between. And if a fire is burning in Montana, it can take days and sometimes longer to have the assets available to allocate to that incident, said Bridger Aerospace's chief executive officer, Tim Sheehy. That's why they're voicing their support of House Bill 883, which would invest $186 million to reduce wildfires in Montana. Now, before we get into this second part of the article, I want to bring us back to last year, basically this same time last year, where the governor of Montana held a press conference in Helena, gathered all the agencies, and had a conversation about wildfire in the state. If I remember correctly, the National Park Service didn't show up, but the other agencies did. And there was this message of, we're kind of butting heads, and as governor, I want fires to be put out quicker in the state of Montana. And it was, there was kind of some pushback from both sides where some people were like, yes, we need to put out fires faster. And some people were like, no, we don't need to put out fires faster. And of course, you have this political back and forth. But that message was put out there by the governor of Montana. So it was something that was on the docket. It's something that he wanted to make happen. Ultimately, this bill provides funding for the state to stage resources that aren't federal resources to respond quickly and initially to fires while the feds gather what's needed and start bringing people in. But it's $186 million to do this. Continuing, it says, Montana Representative Lou Jones, who's out of Conrad, is the primary sponsor. House Bill 883 is really important for the state of Montana, he says, because it's taking the required fire funding that oftentimes will come from the federal government, and it's letting us position that funding in a place where we can fund state-based assets to fight fires, Sheehy said. Now, if I owned a wildland firefighting company in Montana and saw this bill, I would be ecstatic. Like $186 million being available for this. Wildfire Defense Systems, Bridger Aerospace, and others that are there are probably like, hell yeah, we want this bill to pass. $186 million on the table for us to be staging resources inside of Montana. Like that's a pretty big deal and a good deal if you are those folks. It continues saying the primary sponsor, Mr. Jones, said Montana would be equipped with in-state aerial firefighting resources of their own, keeping at least two large rapid initial attack planes strategically staged, ready to attack a fire and no longer having to rely on federal assets. Quote, one thing House Bill 883 is doing is giving Montana DNRC enough funding to have assets available on deck to launch immediately when fires begin. Aggressive initial attack is the safest, most efficient, and cheapest way to fight a fire, Sheehy said. The numbers say responding to a wildfire right away is critical. There's one study that says when a large aerial asset gets on a fire in less than an hour, the fire will likely be out in less than 3 hours. However, it takes 3 days for large air tankers to arrive. The fire burn duration is extended up to an average of 47 days. Minutes matter and hours definitely matter, said Sheehy. Right now, House Bill 883 is on track to pass after clearing the second reading in the Montana Senate on Thursday. It still needs one Senate reading, and then it's back to the House for concurrence on amendments. So it's looking like this thing has a good chance of passing. And if you're a company inside of Montana that deals with fighting fire, this is a lot of money on the table for you. $186 million that becomes available for staging in-state resources for aggressive initial attack. Now, I could get into an argument or a conversation, really, about, hey, what's right, what's wrong of jumping on fires quickly or not. And you can have that conversation all day long. And I can listen to both sides and plays devil's advocate on both sides as well. But where we are in reality is the governor has expressed this is what he wants to do. He wants aggressive initial attack. He wants less managed fires, at least if he's sticking to what he said last year when he spoke on this, that's the plan. That's the policy that is being pushed in Montana. Now you have $186 million on the table to make that happen, and it's looking like it's going to pass. I'm curious to see what changes are initially made when this makes it through, or if it makes it through, and the results of that. You know, is the state of Montana going to push that scoopers and other resources that are staged in the state take action on federal lands? Or is this state land only? They're mentioning the DNRC, so it's probably a lot of state land for that. But it also provides funding just to have resources available all the time. Like, this makes it available so you never lose scoopers, basically, is what it is. And Montana will always have access to them. So if there's a PL5 and everybody else is sucking up resources, this basically guarantees the state of Montana retains those resources and isn't fighting for them and basically gets funded out of the state budget. Very interesting. Bridger Aerospace is having an open house next weekend. Maybe they'll touch on it there. I'm hoping to go. I'm going to be in Montana next week, so I might pop my head in the door and just take a little tour. I'd love to see what they got going on there. But again, if you are a wildland firefighting company in Montana, this is the golden ticket, really. It's $186 million for you to divvy up with all the other resources in the state. We'll see if it passes. It looks like it's going to. And then I'd like to see what evolves from it all. The other thing I want to quickly cover before we move on to what's going up in Oregon, the governor of Idaho came out and said he wants to provide firefighter training for the loggers in the state and basically rope in all of their heavy equipment and make it available for contract if they go online and take the initial firefighting courses to get certified. This was out of Idaho News, and it says, Idaho is training their loggers to fight forest fires, saying that in the first state of the state and budget address back in 2019, Governor Little of Idaho talked about Idaho's leadership in embracing fresh collaborative approaches to land and fire management. He pointed to the hundreds of ranchers and farmers who became members of the Rangeland Fire Protection Association across the state. Quote, I want to carry over this successful wildland firefighting model to Idaho's forest lands by expanding the initial attack capabilities of our loggers, the governor said. The IDL online fire training portal provides access to training resources that will qualify these boots on the ground to safely fight fire within areas where the IDL provides fire protection. The portal connects forestry professionals with traditional in-person or virtual classes and free self-directed online learning. With proper training, owners and operators of heavy equipment can become eligible to contract for fire suppression work, adding to the state's firefighting capacity while benefiting the local communities. Building wildfire suppression capacity by empowering loggers, industrial landowners, and foresters to safely fight fires leads Idaho to greater self-sufficiency, Governor Little said. We're making it easier to access the training and certification needed to safely fight fire, enabling industry folks to extend their helpful hands when fire strikes. So now you have the governor of Idaho saying, we can't rely on the feds either, so we need to bolster our state assets and our state firefighting resources. And the move that they're making to do that is they're opening up fire training and contracting to all the loggers in the state and saying, hey, if you get this training done and a fire breaks out on our jurisdiction, on lands that we have access to and have jurisdiction for suppressing wildfire, we'll call you up and we'll pay you money if you take this training, and we'll bring over your dozers and your feller bunchers and everything else that you got, and we'll put you to work. It's an interesting trend just this last week in these two states where they're like, hey, we can't rely on the feds anymore, so we're taking state money from a surplus that we have, and we're putting it towards bolstering these resources locally. Montana's investing almost $200 million. If their bill passes, this bill 883, and the governor of Idaho opened up this portal to the forestry workers in the state to bolster the ranks. It's interesting to see, and I'm curious if more states, specifically in that region, maybe Wyoming will start doing this. the Dakotas might start doing this, especially if these things become very successful in their neighboring states. And then really, you have to start looking at, are the feds going to start butting heads with them and say, why don't you rely on us? Or, hey, thanks for taking some of that off of our shoulders. That's yet to be seen. But we know there's a worker shortage in this industry and all sorts of other industries, which is amazing. Just here's a fact that this is a total side note, but it just popped into my brain. Amazon, the corporation Amazon, laid off something like 176,000 people in the last little under a year. They laid off 176,000 people. So maybe there's not a worker shortage. Maybe people just aren't hiring. But we know in the wildland industry, there's a lot of folks who just can't get folks to apply. But it sounds like Amazon laid off 176,000 people. So maybe you'll have some employees now who need some work. Crazy side note, but I couldn't believe that number when I read it just this last week when they had an earnings call and they started laying out all these numbers. And I was like, gee whiz, that's a lot of people. And then their stock went up. When you announce you laid off 176,000 people, your stock goes up. Anyway, it's corrected now. And enough about the market. These states are actively showing that they're willing to put money down and bring local communities in to bolster firefighting ranks within the state while saying we can no longer rely on federal resources to quickly and adequately respond to wildfires within our borders. Fascinating stuff. We'll see where it goes. I should be out in Montana. Holler at me. And yeah, it should be a good time. I'll take this time to thank all the paid Substack subscribers that we have. None of this is possible without it. As most people probably know by now, I'm 100% ad-free, sponsorship-free. And the only way that I continue doing this and can take time out of my weeks to put this information out there, to record and edit and produce all the content that I do, it's because of those paid Substack subscribers. So thank you very much. It supports everything that we do. If you want to participate in that, just go to thehotshotwakeup.substack.com, click on the subscribe button, and it's just $6. There should be a link below as well. And again, thank you very much. The Substack itself has exploded. We're pushing towards 10,000 free subscribers, which is insane. I've talked to companies out there, and they ask me, they're like, hey, how big is your email list? How big is your mailing list? And I tell them, and they're like, geez, that's bigger than ours. And so I thank you. The free subscribers, you guys like and share what I do, and that helps out as well. And I'm just happy that this community has grown to where it has and to the size that it has. I never really expected that. But again, thank you to the paid Substack subscribers. It keeps the operation running. Otherwise, I couldn't do what I do. So thank you very much.
I have traveled this year over all the United States, through the Alleghenies, the White Mountains, and the Catskills, the Rockies and the Bitterroot Mountains, the Cascades, the Coast Range, and the Sierras. I have traveled.
So out in Oregon, there's a massive trial that just got underway dealing with PacifiCorp, the power company out there, residents, the state, and it's billions of dollars that the lawsuit is, $1.6 billion, which is an insane amount of money. And basically, it goes into talking about how it wraps up in the corporate world and who's ultimately going to pay for all this stuff. You know, 9 people died in these fires that the lawsuit's over, thousands of homes, over 1 million acres burned. And the OPB out of Oregon wrote a very extensive article talking about all of this. And like I said, this just got underway. They're doing jury selection. And then we're off to the races to see how this is all going to shake out. The beginning of the article kind of just gives you a timeline and a personal look at some of the individuals that lost their homes and were involved in this fire. But as we dig deeper, it gets into the details of the lawsuit, saying that Mr. Edge is one of the 17 named plaintiffs in a $1.6 billion class action lawsuit that accuses the utility PacifiCorp of failing to shut off the power the night that this fire took place, allowing damaged electrical equipment to start fires that destroyed homes. Ultimately, they're saying that a transformer blew up and then started this fire. The Santiam Canyon fire was one of many that burned across Oregon during an unprecedented windstorm Labor Day weekend of 2020. The fires were the most costly in Oregon history, killing at least 9 people, demolishing thousands of homes, and burning more than 1 million acres statewide. So very, very, very destructive. State and federal estimates of the financial cost have ranged between $622 million to over $1 billion. But federal investigators of those fires are still ongoing, or those investigations are still going, and it's unclear how much of the damage can be tied to the power lines. Hence, we're going to court, people. That's why this thing's getting shaked out in the courtroom. Edge, who is 60 years old, lost his 2-bedroom house, a tool shed, and almost all of his belongings to the fire that burned through the town of Gates. He spent the past 2 years rebuilding, went into debt to finish the construction, and just moved into his new home 2 months ago. Quote, up until then, technically, we had no place to live, he told OPB. It's been a nightmare ever since this has happened. My whole life is flipped upside down. Insurance money helped Edge replace much of what he lost, but not everything. Family photos and keepsakes from his parents and grandparents are irreplaceable. We took a big loss, and we were attempting to build everything back together close to what it used to be. But they'll never be what it used to be, he said. You don't ever get it back. You have to start over. A trial in the class action lawsuit is scheduled to begin Monday. And again, that's this past Monday. Though the parties have told the court they're in ongoing mediation talks to reach a settlement. Very, very interesting. If the negotiators don't reach an agreement, the case will likely be the first time a class action lawsuit against a utility over wildfire has gone to trial, according to attorneys. Yep. There's been a lot of settlements in California and other places, and basically a lot of these corporations just want to settle outside of court. PacifiCorp, a subsidiary of billionaire investor Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, has paid out settlements before related to wildfires in Oregon, including for a Southern Oregon fire that its equipment allegedly started in 2020. If a jury finds PacifiCorp was negligent in how it handled the Labor Day fires, it could result in a massive payout for plaintiffs in this case and a larger class action of 2,455 people who had property damaged by the Echo Mountain Complex, the South Oban Chain Fire, the 242 Fire, and the Santiam Canyon Fires. These fires affected Lincoln, Jackson, Klamath, Marion, and Linn counties. Despite the financial risk involved, PacifiCorp appears to take the case to trial. The company has declined to comment on this litigation. And then it brings us into the details of the fire. What's interesting is I don't believe this is the first time the parent company, Berkshire Hathaway, has had a subsidiary sued for wildfires. They own a lot of railroads as well, and there's all these railroad fires that start. I believe the company that they own, Canadian Railway Lines, has been sued for wildfire. I believe. I'd have to double check, but I remember reading something like that. And it's interesting because Warren Buffett is seen as this great billionaire figure. You know, he walks around and drinks Diet Coke or Cherry Coke or whatever it is, eats ice cream, and everybody seems to love the guy. But at the same time, and I'm not condemning someone for owning a company that is alleged to have destroyed, you know, a lot of homes and actually killed people. You know, he's probably not seen the day-to-day operations of that company. But when it, ultimately, if you're traded on the stock market, your main goal is share price and shareholders. So when someone tells you to shut the power off because there might be a wildfire, you're probably hesitant, or your managers are probably hesitant to do that, because ultimately you need to make money to survive. That's how the corporate world works. So I'm curious where this will go. $1.6 billion is a lot of money to strip off of any company's balance sheet, even if you are as large as they are. And it's a big deal. So the article continues saying, what is PacifiCorp accused of doing? It says the main complaint in the lawsuit revolves around whether PacifiCorps turned off its electric lines and equipment in areas extreme risks for wildfire on Labor Day weekend, which was in 2020. The months leading up to the fires had been very dry in Oregon, and fire danger became significant as the state braced for strong east winds. On the Friday before Labor Day, September 4th, the National Weather Service warned people of elevated fire risks and of gusty winds. I believe they had red flags happening through Labor Day weekend. It says hours before the September 7th weather event, state officials said that they directly warned PacifiCorps and other power providers to de-energize some of their lines. So the state covered their bases and said, hey, it's looking like if something sparks with these winds, we're going to get a fire. So just a heads up, here are some areas we think you should de-energize for a little bit. Again, this is the beauty of burying power lines. We know it's a very expensive thing to do. PG&E said they were going to do it. Something like 2,000 miles of power lines they were going to bury in California this year. But they've already backtracked on it and said, maybe we'll get 1,000 miles of it done. We can't do what we initially projected. And they were honest. They said it's going to cost too much money and it's going to affect shareholder value. And we're just not going to put that much money towards burying these things. It is the answer to these types of wildfires. But again, it costs a lot of money to bury existing power lines. It continues saying the plaintiffs in the case allege PacifiCorps ignored those warnings and kept electrical equipment charged through densely wooded areas, such as the Santiam Canyon, and the weather intensified. Other power providers, including Portland General Electric and Consumers Power, which serves the Santiam Canyon, turned some of their lines off. A 2021 investigation by OPB confirmed 13 callers to 911 in Marion County reported power line fires. 13, it says. 13 people called in power line fires that day. And also reporting explosions between 6 p.m. and 10 p.m. on Labor Day, as tree limbs and power poles fell due to high winds. The Northwest Interagency Coordination Center estimated in its 2020 fire season report that the Echo Mountain Complex, South Oben Chain, and 242 wildfires burned just under 50,000 acres, and it destroyed approximately 430 structures. Fire acreage for the Santiam Canyon fires are more difficult to estimate because those fires were eventually subsumed by the Beachy Creek fire, which started in an old-growth forest on the Opal Creek Wilderness and spread through the Santiam Canyon as the winds pushed it eastward. In total, the Beachy Creek fire destroyed more than 193,000 acres and approximately 1,323 structures. That's a bad fire. The causes of these wildfires will be a central debate during the trial. People whose homes burned point to the 911 calls and other eyewitness accounts gathering ahead of the trial as evidence that PacifiCorps equipment operated by Pacific Power sparked these fires. One of the fires that can most clearly be linked to Pacific Power equipment ignited at the Gates School, where a fallen power pole appeared to start a brush and structure on fire. Firefighters with Incident Command Team 13 had gathered at the school grounds as they fought the Beachy Creek fire, which at the time was about 10 miles away from Opal Creek. Firefighter Todd Meyer was one of the people who called 911, and he reported a downed power line. The transmission was, quote, "We've got a brush fire going, lines are down, and a structure fire. It started with lines down, send a full response, quote, I'm a firefighter." Court records show jurors in the case are likely to see a wide array of evidence from internal communications among PacifiCorps staff to photographs and testimony from fire experts. Attorneys for the plaintiffs have also accused PacifiCorps of collecting equipment and vegetation in the days and weeks after the fires to dispose of it and avoid scrutiny. This is why most of these companies try to settle out of court, because if you go to trial, you go to something called discovery. And then all of these things have to become public. And now, theoretically, if you were a power company and there is evidence of you collecting material and equipment and disposing of it to try to reduce scrutiny or get rid of evidence, hypothetically, you want to settle outside of court if you think that's going to be made public in discovery. and then you end up paying a lot of money to keep that quiet. So again, this is a very interesting trial, $1.6 billion. In a deposition with attorneys, PacifiCorps claims adjuster Marlo Vass said equipment collected from the Gates School fire was taken to one or two spots and then probably taken to a dump. The plaintiffs allege similar equipment removals happened at the Echo Mountain Complex fires and elsewhere before investigators could get finished. That's something that was quickly avoided in California last year. Off the top of my head, I can't remember the fire, but it was later in the season. It was a big fire. It was on the El Dorado, and another forest, again, burned up towards a school, assumed to be started by a PG&E power line. There was a criminal investigation that took place, but it was a big deal because the feds rolled in and started confiscating power poles. And to keep this sort of thing from happening, I would assume. So maybe they already learned from this whole case and were like, hey, if there's an accusation that these things started off of a power pole or equipment, we need to call it an active investigation and move in and start confiscating all this stuff. Fascinating that this is the way we're operating now. And it sounds like you almost have to. And then we get into what PacifiCorps' defense is. And it says, as recently as April 7th, PacifiCorps attorneys argued in court that the case does not meet the criteria for a class action lawsuit. So they're just saying this thing is invalid from the start. PacifiCorps has previously said its liability would need to be argued for each fire damaged property. So a house-by-house basis, can't do it together in class action, and not through a group complaint. The county circuit judge, Stephen Alexander, rejected that argument, but a trial memo for the case indicates attorneys for PacifiCorps anticipate raising similar issues in court, suggesting at least part of their arguments against the case will revolve around technical definitions for the class. Okay, so they're getting out the magnifying glass and picking holes in this and saying this isn't even valid. You can't bring this lawsuit because of this, this, and this. Technical definitions. So basically, they're looking at the T's and the I's and seeing if they're crossed or dotted, and that's what they're going to court with. Depositions collected by PacifiCorps attorneys also suggest the company may dispute the origin of certain particular fires. On March 30th, an attorney for PacifiCorps questioned James Ronald Klo, a 76-year-old Gates resident who lives near Potato Hill in the Santiam Canyon. Klo said he awoke after 9 p.m. on Labor Day to find his power out. Sometime between 10:30 and 11, it was like a meteor shower coming in from the northeast, and we had embers, some of them bigger than softballs, and some of them tiny ones, Klo told attorneys. I had thousands of embers on my property, all over my roofs. Though PacifiCorps has declined to publicly comment on the case, it's possible the company's attorneys will argue high winds carried those embers east of the Beachy Creek fire and started these new fires near Gates. So the assumption is PacifiCorps is going to say it wasn't our power lines that started these fires. It was embers that started spot fires from a different wildfire, this Beachy Creek fire. And that's why all these fires started. It was ember wash, as you call it, and wasn't faulty equipment. Klo said that he didn't see power equipment on his property damaged, though he did notice some damage on an adjacent property. PacifiCorps may also hope to sway jurors who think that the fires could have been stopped if firefighters had been able to suppress the Beachy Creek fire, which lightning ignited weeks earlier deep in the national forest. So it sounds like they're going to rope firefighters into this. Ralph Blomers, an environmental attorney, interesting, who had conducted extensive interviews with victims of the 2020 wildfires, but is not involved in the case, said PacifiCorps could use public opinion about federal land managers to its advantage. Now, that's where the politics come in. They're going to say that the firefighters didn't suppress the fire fast enough. They let it burn. It's their fault for trying to manage a fire when the thing blew up. Sounds like that's their argument. And they're saying that public opinion for federal firefighters is so low in Oregon that when they pick a jury, they will already be so out of favor with believing federal firefighters did good that they'll win a jury case. Very interesting. Public opinion and politics brought into this whole thing. Not surprised, but I guess they're going to do what they got to do to win the case. They don't want to pay out $1.6 billion. Blomer said, the environmental attorney, quote, I think there may be an element where they've done some research. They've looked at the polling and they have looked at the public views and people think it's a forest mismanagement thing. So they're thinking they can just convince the jury, hey, you all know sitting on the jury here that the federal response to these fires was botched. So it couldn't have been us. It had to have been mismanagement, which caused ember wash, which then caused spot fires. And we're not liable for any of this stuff. It goes on to say, well, what about the investigations of these fires? And to that question, it says state and federal agencies have not yet completed their investigations of the wildfires at the center of this lawsuit. So 2 years in, federal investigators still haven't determined a cause. There's a couple down in New Mexico that are that way as well, pending. However, if you ask local firefighters how they started, they will gladly tell you how they started in detail. I find that stuff fascinating. But it says, of the wildfires at the center of this lawsuit, they're still under investigation. There's no official findings on how each of these fires started or the role power lines played in the Santiam Canyon, Beachy Creek, South Obenchain, the Echo Mountain Complex, and the 242 fires. No official cause. The Oregon Department of Forestry still has 18 ongoing investigations into the fires that burned across 1.2 million acres of Oregon in 2020. The investigators say, we recognize this is over 2 years after the fact of these fires, and the public has been patiently waiting for the final investigation reports. The complexity and sheer number of fires on the landscape at one time is a lot for an agency to handle. I don't doubt that. It's probably a very true statement. We are moving as quickly as we can while ensuring a complete, accurate, and thorough accounting of these devastating events. Under Oregon law, the investigations are not publicly available while they are going on, and they are exempt from public record disclosure if there is a chance the state will pursue litigation against a responsible party. So 2 years in, no investigation has found an official result, but there's a law in Oregon that says you don't have to make the investigation public if we plan on suing you. So maybe it's looking like Oregon's going to sue PacifiCorps. It kind of looks like that's the case. Maybe they're watching to see what happens with the class action to see if it's worth their time to sue these people. Closing out, it says the complaint also requests that PacifiCorps pay for the reforestation efforts in the affected areas, and it could owe further punitive damages, which a judge recently noted would be an option. The plaintiffs also want the court to require PacifiCorps to turn off its power lines in the future in part of Oregon experiencing extremely critical fire conditions, among other fire mitigation measures. All of those measures would be decided only if the trial determines the utility was negligent. Now, we can start looking at California and PG&E if we want to understand what's going to happen if PacifiCorps gets litigated into the ground. And in California, as we know, PG&E was sued. They lost billions of dollars. They filed for bankruptcy, basically held the power infrastructure of the state over the head of the state and the taxpayers and said, you got to bail us out. Gavin Newsom bailed them out. There's some campaign contribution things going on there, and maybe some Gavin Newsom's wife received some money from PG&E for her nonprofit foundations. Look into it. There's mainstream articles talking about it. I'm not insinuating foul play. I'm just insinuating there's a lot of dots to connect. And now PG&E is back operating, saying, hey, we're going to bury power lines. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. And slowly but surely, they've actually started to pull back on those promises as well. I'm not here to condemn power companies. If you don't have power, you're screwed. Plain and simple. You need power to survive. You need power to build things. You need power to live. But at the same time, they are a publicly traded corporation, and they don't want to lose money. They're not in the game of losing money. So they're going to fight this stuff, and they're going to try to protect their shareholders. Ultimately, if they here's the prediction. If they get convicted and they lose a jury trial, if it goes that far, and they are charged $1.6 billion, basically, I assume PacifiCorp is going to file for bankruptcy. They'll get bankruptcy protection. Maybe they'll get a new company or an umbrella company to come in and be the new entity for that while still operating, and also talking to Oregon government and saying, hey, if we go out of business, you're going to lose the power here in your state. And they have a card to play. You could say it's a power move, with pun intended. It's a power move. So we'll see what comes out of that. The trial's just starting, or I guess jury selection is starting, so it's getting close. And if it does go to trial, we'll get discovery, and then all sorts of juicy details come out of that. So we'll be looking forward to that. Again, I'd like to take this time to thank our paid subscribers on Substack. If you want to participate in that and support everything that we do here at the Hotshot Wake Up, just go to thehotshotwakeup.substack.com. There's a link below as well. Click on subscribe. It's just $6 to do that. And you support everything that we do here. On that note, May, we should start seeing lots of fires start. All of the new growth from all the precipitation will start to cure out. Things will become available to receive fire and carry it. And everybody across the nation will probably get much more busy. This time last year, Region 3 was already at a PL4. So that gives you an idea of the difference 1 year can make from fire season to fire season. And I think it's important for people to realize that it's really not all doom and gloom. And there's a cycle. It's a fire cycle. And year to year, it changes. It's not always getting worse. It's not always getting better. There is a cycle. But if we want to look at trends, as we move into May, we're going to get busier. So be prepped for that. There's already some people fighting fire in California, New Mexico, other places. Crews from Region 4, which is the Great Basin, Utah, those areas are headed to Region 1 to do some prescribed burning. So they're moving around. Big Bear Hotshots were on the Knob Fire. And there's people bopping around the country. It's just not very, very busy. So on that note, reach out to someone you haven't talked to in a while. Say what's up. Eat some good food. Hydrate, stretch, get a workout in, but remember to get the rest you need for that recovery. But as always, when you get up, you got to get it done. Yeah.